Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
And there is René Arnoux, the man who for so long looked as though he had got the race in his pocket, but he hadn't. The turbo let him down, and John Watson is now on lap 68 out of 68. This is the victory lap. They know it. He knows it. We know it. He's only got half a lap to go, less than half a lap to go, because it is from Abbey Curve up to Woodcote, under the bridge, into the chicane. He's won because he could coast home now. Into the chicane, the crowd roars, and the British Grand Prix has been won by a British car with a British driver, his name John Watson. And there's the victory salute.
John Watson, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Joe.
I presume that was a good day?
38 years ago. It was a beautiful day. It was a Saturday. It was not quite as hot as it is right now, but it was certainly a very warm day. Special day for many people, not least of all, I think, for the fans that turned up. They saw a win, which they maybe hadn't anticipated. But I think because of that, it was all the more pleasurable. And I've been very fortunate over, 38 years since, to have met a great deal of people who were present that day. Many of them were probably children, because they're probably in their middle 40s, early 50s now. Mm. So I think that was the biggest memory that I hold. But for a technological point of view, it was the first Grand Prix that was won by a full carbon fiber chassis Formula One car, which of course was a pathfinder to what now is de rigueur in motorsport across the board.
Oh, is that right? I didn't realize that. And did the technological changes down the years change the demands on a driver?
I think in my generation, I came in when the cars were pretty uncomplicated in terms they were very manual, in the sense that a clutch pedal, a normal connection between the brake and the driver, or the throttle pedal and the engine. So there were straightforward cars. It was probably more towards the end of the end of the 70s when, first of all, turbocharging, which is now something we all probably have, most people would have some form of turbocharging in the road car that they might drive. That was new technology. At the same time, ground effects, which I think is a great way of producing downforce, but having a clean and uncomplicated aero package on a race car. And then, of course, it all evolved beyond that, and it's now gotten into an era where the complexities are, I think, blurring the sport.
Mm. Well, we might touch on that towards the end. Now, in all this time we've talked to you over the last couple of years, I don't know actually where you live. I think outside Oxford, I might have read.
Just outside Oxford, yes. I've been here for almost three decades now.
Okay. And Belfast, born and bred?
Born in Belfast, but grew up outside Belfast in a lovely area on the shores of Belfast Lough, known as Craigavad. And beside me was a wonderful golf course, having just watched a fantastic match up at Royal Portrush. Shane Lowry did amazing. I mean, unbelievable. So proud of what he did, and so proud of how golf was portrayed in Ireland as an island. Royal Portrush turned it on, I mean, just magnificently.
Yeah, it really was an amazing few days. Where for you, like on the spectrum of possibility, was a Formula One career? Because 1950s, just outside Belfast, I know your father was in the motor trade to some degree, but that's still a hell of a leap for an 8, 9, 10-year-old to be thinking, I might want to get into motorsport.
I think it was maybe most children even today, they have dreams. They see something. I mean, motorsport wasn't very widely covered on broadcasting in those days. Principally, only one channel in the 50s, only had BBC. But some races were televised, certainly Formula One races, Le Mans being another race. And of course, maybe the race that was most influential for me was held at a circuit just outside Belfast called Dundrod, which is still in use for the Ulster Grand Prix for motorcycles. Then it was a major part of world sports car racing. Went there in 1955 with my family, was in the pits and the paddock, saw the stars of the day, saw all the great teams of the day, and it was just a magical moment, and it made me, it really reinforced a nine-year-old's dream of one day being a driver who could compete at that level. Mm. Of course, there was no real route for me to follow, albeit there had been a number of drivers. Desmond Titterington was notable, and he raced there in 1955. And there were a number of other drivers, Bobby Baird, and some of the drivers, Joe Kelly from outside Dublin. who raced at a high level, but they weren't what I would describe as professional drivers, in the sense that when I moved into motorsport, and particularly into Formula 2 and then Formula 1, there was a clear professional path that you could follow.
I saw you talking about how you would race at places like Dunboyne and the Phoenix Park, Irish road racing. What were you good at? What set you apart? What kind of driver were you, John?
I was somebody who took it quite seriously in a period when racing in Ireland primarily was a weekend occupation, a sort of relaxation possibly. And there were a number of very good drivers in that era, and many of them, had they applied themselves or had they taken the chance and focused on maybe attempting to create a professional career, could have done very well. But most of the drivers were people who had a family business or involved in business of some sort, and they focused on just simply racing at weekends, enjoying it, and that was about as far as they wished to take it.
You know, if we talk about different sports, football or international sports, different countries or different areas produce different styles of driving. Was there a particular style of driving on this island?
There were two forms of motor racing. One was on permanent circuits, which, for example, Kirkeston is probably the best known circuit. And then on the other hand, Dunboyne, which was a once-a-year race, and Phoenix Park, again, a once-a-year race. And they were pure road circuits. And, I mean, because of their nature, I really enjoyed them. They were a major challenge. And I think it made the driver focus very much more on, first of all, on the precision that was required to race on those kind of racetracks, but therefore the fulfillment and satisfaction that you would have received from doing a good job was probably that much greater than racing on the wide open spaces of an ex-airfield or a military airfield.
Because I did see you described elsewhere as a very precise driver, so maybe that's the reasoning.
Well, I enjoyed certainly my racing on those road circuits. Dunboyne was a pure road circuit. Phoenix Park is using the main drag through the park, and then the loop roads. In fact, the first time I raced in Phoenix Park, we were using part of the racetrack that went around the back of the Dublin Zoo.
Right. And would you get good crowds at them back in the day?
At Dunboyne, you'd get a crowd, yes. I mean, all the locals, because it was free, they would rock up. And Phoenix Park, likewise, I think it was a free venue. It's a public park, a municipal park. So I think people would come to it and they enjoyed it. And one of the attractions of those two particular races was that they were at a higher level than the average, what might be described as club race meeting in Ireland, because they attracted international entries.
Right.
So you were seeing, for example, in the days of Formula Junior, a man called Ken Tyrrell ran a Formula Junior team, and he raced his cars at Dunboyne. I think, I'm not sure if they raced at Phoenix Park or not. Other race drivers, I remember one man in particular, South African, Bob Ultoff, driving an MGA twin cam, sitting in a grandstand watching him come into the village in Dunboyne. Unbelievable. And then a year or two later, in an Austin Healey 3000, even more unbelievable. And the only thing that was even better than that was A.K. Poole, the pooler from Dublin, Booth Poole, the son of Bill Poole, in his hybrid Austin Healey Sprite. He drove the wheels off that little car, the quickest Austin Healey Sprite I've ever seen in the world.
And this is what, 1960s, 1970s?
This is the early 60s, 63, 64.
Okay, amazing. So
the Formula Junior was actually pre that, it was 61, 62.
And what about money and all this when you're trying to get started? Do you have to come from a wealthy family? Do you kind of cobble it together yourself? Are you relying on the local butcher to sponsor you? How does all this work?
Probably every one of those things. I mean, in my case, it was a family affair. And my father, as you mentioned, was in the motor business in Belfast. And then he raced in the 50s primarily. Then in the early 60s, it was my turn, so role reversal. It was still a family affair, and it was very much, I think, the intention that I would follow my father into the business and eventually would take over that business. But as I say, I had a dream. And my dream was not to be selling motor cars in Belfast, but was to be on a world stage racing at the highest level. And that was the thing that I focused upon all the way through the 5 or 6 years that I raced in Ireland. Ultimately, I had an opportunity in 1969 in England at a Formula 2 race meeting, and it gave me the understanding, as did other people around, that I had enough ability and talent to be able to go out and compete on a level playing field with the best in the world in Formula 2.
And I know you got very established at Formula 2 and that led to Formula 1. You make your first Formula 1 Grand Prix debut in 1973. I make it you're about 27 years of age then.
Actually, you're wrong.
Okay, go on.
I made my Formula 1 debut in Phoenix Park.
Go on.
That's got you.
Okay.
Because in 1972, a well-known Dublin motor trader, Anthony, in inverted commas, Monkey Brown.
Right.
You may not have heard of him, but he is a very good motor dealer. He bought a Formula One car called an Eifeland March from another well-known motor dealer at the time, Bernard Charles Eccleston.
Ah.
And somewhere along the line, I'm not quite sure now, it's a long time ago, I got a phone call and said, would you drive the car at Phoenix Park? It was the August meeting. And I thought, well, I don't know much about it. I don't know who this guy is from a hole in the ground. And but I agreed. So I turned up at Phoenix Park, and the car eventually turned up. And I mean, it turned up in a pretty sad state.
Mm.
But got the car running, and I drove it. And that was the first time I actually drove and then raced a Grand Prix car. And then the second time that I raced a Formula One car was at Brands Hatch at the end of 1972, when the car had been then prepared properly by a company or a team that I would then drive for in 1974, a motor dealer again in London called Hexagon of Highgate.
Mm.
So we ran the car in the final non-championship race of 1972 at Brands Hatch, called the Champions Race, or Victory Race, I think it was called. And in that race, I finished sixth overall, which I think for a first time in a Formula One race was a good achievement. And it reflected very well on the preparation that Hexagon had done. And it was a shoestring effort, but it was actually the tease that led Hexagon to commit to Formula One in 1974 to a full season.
Mm. And when you did take to a grid alongside Jackie Stewart and the boys in 73, what's that like? I mean, are you completely bricking yourself, or do you arrive on the scene saying, I'm going to move over everyone, John Watson's here to take over? What kind of character were you?
Well, I was a very, fundamentally very shy person, very self-effacing. And, I mean, to be in a race, in a Grand Prix or a Formula One race, with the likes of Jackie Stewart or Denny Hulme or Graham Hill or all the other stars of that period, to me, was slightly overwhelming, because you know I had one thing that, again, in Formula One today is singularly lacking, and that's respect for your peers. And if you saw Jackie Stewart catching you, for example, you would always be aware that if he was going quicker than you, which he would have been doing, to make sure you don't hold him up. I mean, today, I don't think anybody gives a damn, really, although there are penalties if you don't get out of people's way. But it was an attitude and a time when I revered the stars of Formula One in a Formula One race. And, I mean, if you had Denny Hulme come up to you and say, why didn't you use your mirrors and get out of the way? It was almost like being sent into Borstal and been thrashed by the principal.
Because I did see a quote from Jackie Stewart where he said of you, of a time, you were too nice to win races. Clearly, you had to shed that.
I mean, I know the quote, but I don't remember the period it was spoken in. But there's an element of truth in that. And I suppose one might say that relying on natural ability and talent in a sport like Formula One is only one part of being successful. And there is a lot of other elements and characteristics and part of human nature, which to be a success across the board over a long time, you may have to understand or learn to implement.
Mm.
And, you know, it took a little time for me to get my head around that, because I probably just relied exclusively on ability and talent and not manipulation or politics, which is what many other drivers who maybe had a lesser talent than me but were very successful at exploiting.
Because I know you've talked before about Niki Lauda's ability, for instance, a teammate of yours, to get the team centred around him a little bit. Again, manipulation, cleverness,
yep.
Intelligence, a sense of how to manoeuvre people.
Yes, indeed. And I mean, actually, I was given a very interesting statistic the other day.
Mm.
And over the three seasons that Niki and I were teammates, one at Brabham in 78, and then at McLaren in 82 and 83, we ended up with an identical point score over those 3 years. Now, not many people know that, and I wasn't aware, because I didn't bother counting it. But it just illustrates that my achievement against somebody who would have, at that point was a two-time world champion, went on to be a three-time world champion, was is probably very much underestimated and underappreciated.
Mm. That was an amazing era. You know, you get the tail end of Jackie Stewart, you've got Lauda, you've got Hunt on the scene, Nelson Piquet, Senna's coming through. How collegiate was it all? Were you guys all mates, chumming around, having a great time, or was it pointy elbows?
No, I think in that era, it was very much more camaraderie. The scale of Formula One in terms of, when we were a travelling circus, really, and if you look at a Formula One race today, look at the paddock, for example, 2 weekends ago at Silverstone, I mean, it is just mind-boggling. The amount of financial investment that's in all things, nothing to do with on the racetrack, but just the support. The transporters that take the cars around Europe, the hospitality, or the work centres, they call them. I mean, they're just beyond anybody's imagination. Back in 1972, when we went to Brands Hatch, we had a Ford Transit van with a canvas side awning. It was basic stuff. It was a little better than I would have been using when I was racing in Ireland. And then, I mean, in terms of driver friendships, I think there was a better, say, camaraderie amongst the drivers because the paddock was a very much more open place to mix and match with other drivers. And there were some drivers that you found yourself, you enjoyed their company more than others. I mean, the French, for example, they stick together like you-know-what to a blanket. You know, they tend to go out. If you go out for dinner with a group of French people, it's never less than 20. You know, whereas I don't like that kind of activity. I'd rather go out with maybe two or three or four people and have a dinner and have a laugh. Play golf when you're downtime between events, particularly where you had flyaway events in South America or South Africa, North America. Tennis, golf, whatever. Go out, have dinner, lark around. But nothing that was anything more than just really, you know, grown-up kids enjoying themselves and enjoying their mates.
And you, as we said, John, spent 10 years out there in the Formula One circuit, a five-time Grand Prix winner, third in the 1982 championship. If that happened, certainly, I mean, to the best of my knowledge, in the 90s or in the modern era, you are set for life. I mean, you're walking off into the sunset, a multi-millionaire. You're not worried about money ever again.
Hold on.
Yeah.
The kind of remuneration compared to where we are today, you're talking, shift the decimal point about three places.
You weren't retiring to rest on your nest egg when you stopped.
I mean, Jackie Stewart made very good money, but he made significantly more in his retirement because he was very astute and very well-placed, and he used all those qualities he has to, you know, build a career outside of being a racing driver, but he was still, in the public's mind, a racing driver. And Nicky made very good money, James Hunt did, but there were very, very few that the kind of money that's talked about today with possibly Lewis Hamilton or Vettel or now Max Verstappen, they're earning significantly large sums of money. But sport in general, and largely because of the growth of television and sport and the consequent sponsorship that's flowed. I mean, when I was racing in Argentina in 1974, when the race finished, and it finished about 6 o'clock, I think, in the evening, and went back to the hotel 8 o'clock, which would have been midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning back in my family home, I couldn't ring home. I had to book a phone line and wait for that line to be available before I could ring my family. I mean, you're talking about dark ages, and that's only back in the early 70s.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly things change. The 1982 championship, when you finished third in the standings, is that a regret? How close were you? Your strong kind of sense of that season?
Well, what I did, I finished on equal points with Didier Pironi, and we joined second in terms of points. But on the count back, he had a one more second place or something. It was a year, a very unusual year, because there were about a dozen drivers at one point or another who had a chance to win the world championship. Tragically, Villeneuve killed himself. Pironi tried very hard and didn't succeed, but he broke his leg so badly he wasn't able to continue racing career. In McLaren, Lauda and I were both in a position at different times to have a chance at winning the championship. In fact, I led the championship between sort of end of May, early June, up until July. Opportunities were lost, and in part, I've got to accept some of my responsibilities, and likewise, you know, issues, reliability, from the team's perspective, again, reliability was a different level that we have today. I mean, Formula One has got phenomenal reliability. In the 80s, the reliability was a little bit more stick the tail on the donkey and see where you're going to finish. So it was an opportunity that was lost. And I went into the last Grand Prix in Las Vegas in 82, and I needed to win that Grand Prix. And Keke Rosberg, who at that point had a points advantage, he needed to finish fifth or higher if I won the race. I came second in the race, and Rosberg finished fifth, so he walked out of Las Vegas the world champion. I won two races that year, he won one, but it's about points over the season, not just over victories. So had I won the race, and had he still finished fifth, I would have won the world championship because I would have won three Grand Prix to his one, so that would have made me the 1982 world champion.
Is it something you dwell on now much?
No, it's not, because it's I can't change what occurred. It's something that I realise that there were opportunities, and I think that you have to maybe learn from what has happened in the past for the future, but I can't change it. Clearly, it would have been wonderful for me to have won the world championship. It would have had a changing effect, undoubtedly, because if you win a world championship, you move into another stratosphere of racing driver. You're not just a Grand Prix winner, or you're not just a Grand Prix driver who's never won. So it would have made a difference to my life, and you'd have been then a driver of a more unique group than just being a Grand Prix winner.
We had Nigel Mansell on the show a couple of years ago, and he was talking about the art of driving almost, and he was saying so much of a racing driver's life, or so much of what he felt was his life, was, you know, trying to avoid touching the brake for as long as possible, coming into a turn, avoid touching the brake, and then at the very last second, feather the brake as much as you need to, and then shoot out of the corner and almost berate yourself that you could have waited a fraction longer, this constant to-ing and fro-ing. Can you give us a sense of what was going on in your head in the car? What zone you had to get into mentally? Were you ever thinking about anything but the exact moment of driving and what you were doing? Like, were you completely in the moment, or could your mind sometimes drift to the more mundane things? I suspect not. But can you take us inside your head when you're competing and driving at that ridiculous level?
Well, I think there's two aspects of being at a Grand Prix. One is qualification for your grid position, and then the other is actually the Grand Prix itself. And there are some drivers who are very good at qualifying but not necessarily so good a race driver, and vice versa. For me, the thing that I tried to achieve in my car was a car that would have had a lot of rear-end stability. I mean, I was good in the brakes. No, I'd always outbrake Nigel. Nigel was not that brilliant on brakes, trust me. But being good in brakes gives you certain advantages.
What does being good at brakes mean?
It means being able to use the brake pedal and knowing when to brake, over doing it better than a competitor, and being able to overtake under brakes and knowing what you can and cannot do in a braking zone. And I was good at that.
Right.
And I got better at it as I got older. So that's part of what being a racing driver is. But in itself, it's not everything, because the most important thing is a lap time. And a lap time is constructed from a whole raft of different qualities during that lap. So I could come in, for example, I could come to a corner, and if I'd wanted to, I could have maybe braked 10 meters or 10 yards. Let's talk yards. 10 yards later than I might do, let's say, in a race context. But would have had a bearing or an effect on my corner speed and my corner exit speed. But it was a useful tool to have in a race context. If you're trying to pass somebody who's an awkward sod, so you had to maybe make a commitment to go down the inside. The key to doing that was not just only the braking later, but then making sure that you would compromise that other car, that they wouldn't pick up any advantage from your late braking by trying to make an undercut. So you would modulate the brake pedal. You'd put pressure off and on the brake pedal to ensure that you compromise that other competitor and then maximized your exit speed out of a corner. That's the skill of being good in the brakes as a racing driver. Being able to brake late in itself is not necessarily the be-all and end-all.
Yeah.
It's being able to use a skill like that to your advantage.
You clearly had it, because you had an ability to come from behind in a race. Like in Detroit in 82, you came from 17th position through And in 83, I think you came from 22nd back to win, which was a record at the time. So you
it
had
stands.
It still stands, does it? It's incredible from 22nd right the way through. So you had this ability to get around the awkward sods in front of you.
I did. And I mean, it's something that I think there's a lot of it is down to me. But equally, I think a lot of it is with the cars I was catching and overtaking. And when you create a reputation as being a driver who can overtake and under in some circumstances, difficult racetracks, Detroit, everybody looked at Detroit and sort of thought, oh, you can't pass here because it's a matrix layout and it's stop, start, stop, start.
Mm.
Well, if you adapt an attitude like that, then you won't.
Mm.
And in fact, I mean, as an example, in that particular race, Nicky Lauda, my teammate, adapted that attitude. I came up behind him, passed him into turn one, passed Eddie Cheever into turn 7 or 8, and passed Pironi into turn 11, all in one lap. And all of a sudden, Nicky went, oh, oh. So he took out the chip in his brain that said, you can't pass, went to the box and said, here are the chips that say you can pass. But he overtook all those others. But it took me to show him how to do it.
Mm. Which suggests that mentality is crucial in this sport, more so than most.
Yeah. You have to have restrict what is possible.
Yeah.
There's a lot more possible than at face value what you might believe is possible.
Mm. You mentioned just in the, you know, it's so noticeable, especially when you look at it from this vantage point where everything is so safe, that as we chat here, you reference Villeneuve and you know, Lauda has come up a few times and we've spoken to you about his terrible crash and the burns and the damage to his lungs. So safety standards, I think we're well aware at this stage, weren't what they are today back then. And I know the context for you, I've heard you make the point, the context for you at the time was, well, we thought they were as good safety standards as they could be. But that said, the reality is you saw other drivers die and have injuries. And I know you had a bad crash in 1970 as well. Did you ever come close to losing your nerve or getting afraid? Or did you ever have too healthy a regard for your own health, which affected your driving at any stage?
I think as you get older, that becomes a part. It's just a natural part of getting older. But I think you have to respect the sport, first of all. You have to have self-belief in yourself. You have to believe in your team that they're going to give you a sound and safe car. But as you point out, in the 70s, the cars were, for the period, on the racetracks that we were racing, probably at the limit of what was acceptable in terms of car safety and circuit safety. But as you pointed out, we believed we had the safest circuits, best cars, best medical backup. So we didn't have the benefit of hindsight looking back from 2019 to 1973 or 74.
Mm.
So if we knew what the future was going to be, we would have said, well, bring it on now. Don't let's wait 48 years, 46 years.
And did
it's the evolution of motorsport, and it applies. Look, if you were driving around in 1970 in an Austin A35, a wee Mini, because there's no such thing as a Mini. They're all wee Minis. And you had an accident.
Yeah.
You're probably going to die. Odds on, you would die. If you buy a new Mini today, you've got an infinitely greater chance of maybe having some injury. You might have even severe injury, but you're probably not going to lose your life.
Mm.
That's where technology has changed, and it's changed in Formula One, as it has in the motor industry. You've got tests now. I think it's NCAP, which is really part of what Formula One has sort of gone sideways into, where you've got independent testing for road cars. They're not supplied by manufacturers. They're independently sourced, and they're crash tested independently.
Mm.
And it has led, thankfully, to the industry now producing much, much more secure and safe passenger cars for families, for parents, for children, for whatever. And even in motorsport, the difference in construction of a car and the difference in circuit safety and the backup that's now a part of Formula One is a million miles away from where it was in the early 70s.
And, you know, in different sports, golfers and darts players even can get the yips. And I asked you, you know, about losing your nerve, and you said, well, as you got a bit older, maybe it comes into it to a point. Did any Formula One drivers of your era lose their nerve completely and just, you know, relinquish the ability to be able to drive a car with great speed?
I'm not aware of anyone that I could say he lost his nerve.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if you look, I mean, reference Jackie Stewart.
Yeah.
Jackie got to his 99th Grand Prix in Watkins Glen, 1973, and his teammate, Francois Servais, perished in a pretty appalling accident. I mean, there was a pretty horrible scene. I didn't go to see it, but I gather from what I've heard, it was pretty horrible. And Jackie, he hadn't announced his retirement, but I tell you what, it certainly made him think that he is doing the right thing at the right time for him and his wife and his family.
Mm.
And those are the things, those are the considerations you have to balance against the pure hedonism and self-enjoyment of being a Grand Prix driver, of traveling around the world and having a life. I mean, not necessarily that we earn huge amounts of money, but to me, to be able to travel around the world competing in the, what was a hobby and a profession, I couldn't believe how fortunate I was. And I've been fortunate in a sense all the way through my life, because if I'm not racing, which I haven't done now for nearly 30 years, I've been involved in motorsport through broadcasting, so I'm making a contribution. I'm still involved. I'm still in the paddock. But when I grab a microphone, I'm waiting for the lights to go out because I'm still a racing driver.
Mm. I presume nothing could replace driving a Formula One car, but your broadcasting career was very successful and you were very highly regarded.
It is. It still is.
Yes, no, I know.
I'm going off to Spa tomorrow for the 24 Hours of Spa GT3 Blancpain, biggest race in the sport in the GT world this weekend.
Yeah. I was going to say, to what extent can that fill the hole or the vacuum? I presume only to a small extent.
It fills it pretty well.
Okay.
Because I have no aspirations to be a Grand Prix driver again.
Yeah.
I don't really want to race again, because it was something I did at a point in my life when I was in my early 20s up until my late 30s, and then, in fact, into my middle 40s. You know, I think motorsport is a sport for young competitors, whether they're male or female or anything in between. And I'm not an 18-year-old or a 19-year-old or a 20-year-old. And if I was, if I was ever persuaded to put on a helmet and overalls again, I would only do it on the basis that I would have to spend 6 months going to the gym, going on to a diet, giving up the things that, you know, the pleasures in life, the joys in life that I am able to do now. I mean, if you want to go out, have dinner with friends, or if you want to have a glass of wine or whatever it is you want to do. But if you want to focus and get yourself back into a condition, a physical condition, and therefore a mental condition, you have to start going back to what you did when you were starting off your career in the first place.
Well, John, listen, the clock has come against us, but it's been great to hear a bit about your career and some of your memories, and no doubt we'll talk again soon across the Formula One season. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Joe.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.